Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. In unscripted conversations with investment professionals, you'll hear real stories about successes and lessons learned, informed by decades of investment experience. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. New episodes are available monthly. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.
Hello and welcome to the FT Business Books podcast, the place to discover the best in business writing. I'm Helen Barrett, the FT's work and careers editor. And with me, bringing gravitas to proceedings, is Andrew Hill, FT columnist and management editor. Welcome, Andrew.
Hello.
Hello. This series, we're looking at books to help you through turbulent times, chosen by our top commentators. Today, we're joined by Emma Jacobs, FT columnist, interviewer and all-round favourite scribe. Welcome, Emma.
Hi.
Hello. Emma's choice, Overwhelmed, Work, Love and Play When No One Has the Time, by Washington Post writer Bridget Schulte. A book that attempts to unpack and analyse the quintessentially modern and increasingly universal experience of feeling utterly unable to cope, according to Lev Grossman in Time magazine. But before we get to that book, Emma, what are you reading at the moment?
So I've just finished two books that are sort of related to some of this. The Ariel Levy's book, The Rules Do Not Apply, which is a short memoir by the New Yorker writer, and also a novel that I reviewed for the FT, which was Jamie Attenberg's All Grown Up, which is about a woman not having it all. She doesn't have children or a partner, she has a job that she doesn't really enjoy it, and she's very kind of downbeat. So it's the kind of anti-hyper-excitement busyness that perhaps we're going to talk about soon.
I read your review, which had the marvellous headline, Loveless, Actually,
in the
FT, and I got the impression that you had lost patience with the novel.
The idea that it's new, that there's kind of this rich seam of single women without children telling their story at last, I don't feel that's true anymore. We've had quite a few of those now. But I think that she is a brilliant writer and she's very wry and her prose is very economical and interesting. And also, I think, as I said in the review, there's plenty of white male Brooklyn writers that have trodden similar territory. So why shouldn't women do the same?
Andrew, what are you reading at the moment?
I'm about a third of the way through Helen Dunmore's new novel, Birdcage Walk, which is set in Bristol in the late 18th century. And actually, it does go a bit to the Bridget Schulte thesis, particularly on women and men dividing their roles. They're sort of a central characters, a prototypical couple where the man is doing all the work. He's a property developer, essentially, in late 18th century Bristol, speculating on property overlooking the gorge, and his wife is struggling to kind of create her identity within what is clearly a very sort of male-dominated couple. She is the daughter of two radical writers who also have an interesting division of labour. It starts set in the context of a discovery of this radical woman writer, the mother of the narrator, who is unknown by the 21st century, we're led to believe. And so it takes you back. It's I think, going to develop into a thriller. It certainly has a very sort of tense thriller-type start to it, but enjoying it a lot.
And it's a contemporary book.
Helen Dunmore is a contemporary writer, yes. This is a historical novel.
So it's interesting that she's chosen this theme and
don't know much about... I've never read any work by her before, so I don't know much about the background and why she's chosen this, but clearly it does raise, as all the best historical novels do, some issues that make you reflect on modern life as well, in ways in which Bridget Schulte would recognise, I suspect.
Emma, whenever I walk past your desk, you and Tim Harford, your fellow writer who you sit near, you seem to be behind towers of books, and there's dozens of parcels containing more preview copies seem to arrive every day. In the 4 months since you were last with us on the FT Business Books podcast, what's caught your eye?
Well, you'll be pleased to hear that I've actually cleared my desk recently, so a lot of them have gone in the recycling bin. I think the book that I'm looking forward to reading is the Brad Stone one on Uber and Airbnb, particularly in light of all the news stories that have been coming out in about Uber recently, but also generally on the kind of broader context of the kind of companies that, and creating an environment for gig workers. I think that's my next business book read.
Good choice. Have you read it? No, I haven't read it. No, I'm looking forward to it as well.
Now on to our book of the fortnight. Emma, you have chosen Overwhelmed, Work, Love and Play When No One Has the Time by Bridget Schulte, published in 2014. Can you tell us about it?
So when you asked me to come up with a book for Turbulent Times, I thought about this. I mean, I've held it very dear in my head for a few years now because I decided to read it when I was going on holiday. And normally I don't take business, well, it's not really a business book, but I don't take work-related books on holiday. I try and read novels, but I found myself reading it compulsively, just as I would with a novel. And I've spoken to Bridget subsequently for articles that I've written about work and, you know, how companies help or hinder employees manage their working and home lives. And so I kind of thought that that would be a good book to steer us through difficult times, especially in this kind of era where everybody's looking at Twitter constantly and, you know, how do you manage your time and how do you manage your workload? And, you know, I don't think that the kind of theme that she discusses, which is the overwhelm of life, the kind of confetti, the way that time is divided into kind of confetti-like pieces, has changed much. And but actually rereading it, I had different thoughts, I think.
Which were
that it seemed a bit dated, but I can't think, I mean, it's only been 2.5 years or 3 years, and I can't really think why, and I was just talking to Andrew about why that might be. I mean, I think when she wrote it, even then, it seemed a lot fresher. I mean, this was at a time where other books were coming out on similar sort of themes on time management and also on the kind of women work side. There was Anne-Marie Slaughter and obviously Sheryl Sandberg talking about these, the sort of management of home and work life and how we could do better. So at the time, it seemed quite fresh. There were quite a lot of company policies in Bridget's book that I'd never heard of. And obviously, going back to them, I've heard of them. And some of them are kind of, they don't seem so innovative or kind of groundbreaking anymore. I think she talks about Menlo Park having a four-day week or a cut-off time. And since then, in terms of work, that if you're not at the office, you don't have email exchanges with your line manager and so on. But, you know, subsequently, there's been quite a few well-known policies like SAP. Did it? Was it SAP Volkswagen?
Yeah, VW did it, I think.
But, I mean, who knows what? I mean, there's been no follow-up, as far as I know, about Volkswagen. And so what they implemented was cutting the server off at a certain time, was it?
Yeah, there was a union agreement with one of the German companies, yeah. I think, about not contacting. And I think there's also been some policies in France now.
There have, yeah.
Similarly.
These efforts, these company initiatives to kind of help workers manage the technology flow have kind of superseded her book a bit, I think. I mean, I think interesting to see whether they work, and there's not been that much follow-up as far as I can see on whether they work.
Andrew, did it strike you as a 2014 throwback?
A little bit, yes. I think partly Emma's right. It's to do with the number of books that have appeared. When I got to the end of my electronic version of the book, it threw up, as it does these days, a recommendations of other reading, including things that people who bought this book had read. Mm. And there are about 7 or 8 books that have been published mostly since this one that are on similar themes. I think in that sense, those of us who've read into those types of books recognise quite a lot of it. I think the other reason, when we pose the question to columnists and writers about books for turbulent times, I must say I had in mind turbulent times post-Trump, post-Brexit, you know, the kind of external turbulence. And it seems to me, at least in the last year, that we focused very much on those types of things. And almost, although I can understand that sorting your own overwhelmed inbox or a list of tasks contributes to liberating us to deal with the wider uncertainty, it almost seems like this is a sort of micro version. I don't think there's any reason why this shouldn't be valid in the current geopolitically turbulent times, but it almost seems like there are other things that we are worrying about now that go well beyond this, albeit important, personal turbulence and overwhelmedness.
And it takes the form of an investigation, doesn't it?
Yeah, I like this. I like much of the style that, I mean, I like the kind of general tenor of the book, which is for Bridget, who feels overwhelmed. So Bridget was at the time, she was a Washington Post journalist, and she's got two children and a husband and a busy life. So for her, I think she had this revelation that she was doing she was looking at time diaries, how people use their time. And so there's a huge amount of research into how people use their time. And researchers ask people to keep diaries, and then they'll grade them into whether they're leisure or work and what counts as leisure. And so she was quite shocked when she gave in her time use diary to the researcher, who found that she had 30, or she was told that she would have 30 hours as a working woman of leisure time. And to her, it felt that that wasn't the case at all. And so when she went through some of the diary with him, he was saying, you listening to the radio in bed in the morning, that's leisure time. And she was saying, but I feel like I'm struggling to get out of bed. Doesn't feel very leisurely to me. And then there was one bit where she breaks down the side of the road, and he writes that down as leisure because she was sitting there playing with her daughter. And then she
for
said,
2 hours.
For two hours. And she said, didn't feel very leisurely. And he said, hold on a minute, I'll recategorise that as childcare. So she said, if my child hadn't been in the car with me, this would have been leisure, but now it's work. So it was really kind of an examination, and it kind of took her into different policy. I mean, I completely... That, you know, obviously the news agenda is much more concerned with macro policies, but some of these things, I think, as we'll discuss, are kind of, you know, the US has terrible policies on childcare, and this feeds into workers and discontent generally.
Oh, totally. And I think that's actually another reason why perhaps it needs an update. It'd be interesting to hear from her about that, that there is, we've moved into a Trump era, and it seems possible to me that re-emphasis on so-called traditional families. She goes to interview Pat Buchanan, and the conservative politician who eventually ran unsuccessfully on a populist campaign for president in the mid-90s, but who was a great campaigner for traditional families. And clearly she's critical of that. She points out at one point that that she doesn't feel in any way like her family is an untraditional family, that it's, and all that she is a crumbling part of the campaign that he still adheres to benefit the more traditional woman at home, man at work approach to family life. But it does seem to me that there is, under Trump, the strong possibility that that traditional family campaign has got new life, and therefore that some of the things that she's addressing, I think, as progress may well be set back. We could argue that just gives the book more relevance now than it has ever had, but clearly when she wrote it, the trajectory at any rate seemed to be toward, away from the traditional family approach, more towards the progressive approach. Perhaps I'm over-optimistic about that.
Does she make the case for universal childcare, do you think? Does she make that case effectively?
I think she's more that something needs to be done and we're not doing it. And the US maternity leave, and that there isn't one. I mean, even Ivanka Trump made that point herself recently. To go back to the turbulent times theme, I think that there's a real danger with the sort of narrative. I mean, obviously, there are huge issues, trade policies and whether we're going to go to war with North Korea and so on. But the there are very pressing, you know, worrying issues. But I think there's a sort of emerging narrative that, you know, that women and diversity and issues about identity politics have kind of had their day. And that's why, you know, we've kind of got, you know, as a reaction, we've now got Trump, or even to some extent Brexit, that, you know, that this is, we're not interested in identity politics. Hearing women or ethnic minorities bleating on about their own agenda is not important. And I think that there is a danger that we kind of forget that some of these other issues are still ongoing. I mean, they are important and they are significant and they shouldn't be forgotten.
Yeah, I think that's inevitably the riposte to Bridget Schulte today would be, you know, we've got more important fish to fry now. And that, but that is a very obvious way of excusing no progress on on rather important policy issues that she that she touches on. But having said that, quite a lot of the book, I think most of the book, is more about the personal ways in which you can handle that, the overwhelm, as she calls it.
I mean, I feel with the news agenda generally, I feel not that I'm particularly working harder, but my attention is much more fractured, and you know, I'm constantly looking at updates. I mean, it might have eased
up
a bit.
We are journalists, I guess that does make a difference.
Yes, of course.
And Bridget Shultra is, of course, as well.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that you get absorbed in it. I mean, I called an economist recently for a story, and he said, could you call me early? In fact, he sent me an email, could you call me early to get me out of this Twitter hole? Because I've got sucked into looking at, you know, the news agenda, and please get me out of it again. So obviously, we get more distracted than possibly people on construction sites, but it is absorbing, and people are still worried how to deal with the kind of overwhelming information overload.
Yes,
Andrew, do you feel overwhelmed?
How are you feeling today?
I mean, let's put on the table the obvious thing we haven't talked about, which is that her book is very much about how overwhelmed working women feel. And so I didn't feel that I was the constituency most addressed by the book itself. I think that's fair.
But you, I mean, did you feel guilty because you recognised things in it, or because...
Yes, recognised some things in it. I went home and I said to my wife, who has a more flexible working schedule as a private tutor, that I was reading this book and I was really interested to chat to her about it. And she literally responded, not now. So I think there is a difference between the way in which I took it. And it does address that. So when I say that I don't feel overwhelmed, that's not quite right. What I did feel, and I'm not sure it was really quite addressed in the book, it seems to me to bit paints two extremes. People, mainly women, who are completely overwhelmed, and they're pretty annoying, actually, after she's gone on about it for a while. And then at the other extreme, and equally annoying, people who seem to have reached some nirvana of balance, or at least acceptance of the busyness in their lives. Now, I personally feel that my world shuttles between occasionally feeling overwhelmed and then moving beyond a peak of deadlines or particular stresses into a period where I feel I'm balancing these things, and I've managed to reach a point where I'm appreciating the sunset or some of the other things that she advises we should be doing. So now that's not necessarily a male or female reaction. I thought the two extremes were each equally unrealistic compared with what I think more of the day of daily life being a sort of curve between these various areas of being overwhelmed and being appreciative of the things around you.
It's interesting, Emma, your edition of the book is a first edition, probably. It's an early edition, and it's just got a plain sort of typefaced cover.
It's a to-do list.
It's a to-do list, yes. The more recent edition, I noticed, had a silhouette of a woman, and it was more packaged like almost like a chick lit novel from the 90s. And I wondered about whether the publishers had decided to repackage it and aim it at, specifically at women, as a woman's book.
I mean, I think that it is aimed at women. I mean, which is sort of unfortunate in a way. I mean, I think that the elephant in the room is the husband in the book, which we've discussed.
He's often not in the room.
He's not in the room.
Exactly.
Tom. Yeah. I mean, you know, who knows what goes on in people's marriages, really. But the part of her problem is that they're not dividing the workload, the family load, equally, or even at all, it seems. So he gets to enjoy post-children's birthday parties by kind of sitting out in the chair and reflecting on their children while she's kind of tidying up manically. So I think that it's a shame that these kind of gender divisions aren't brought up in a way that doesn't antagonise men. But, I mean, I don't know whether you felt antagonised. But then again, you don't want to kind of be too apologetic.
Do you mean
kind
you
of
think she descends into stereotypes? Do you think she's exaggerating some of these vignettes at home?
She must be.
I wonder about that, because I think if you go to a publisher and you're saying, I'm going to write this book about being overwhelmed, you can't say what I've just said, which is, well, sometimes I feel overwhelmed, but other times, actually, I just feel like I've kind of quite got the balance about right. The publisher's going to say, We want all the overwhelm at the
all
beginning,
the time.
All the time, and we want the worst cases of it. And poor Tom, who doesn't come across sympathetically until the end when they seem to have managed to sort things out, presumably his more positive attributes get a bit edited out in that process. Just back to the point about the title, she says in the preface to the electronic edition that I was looking at that she adds this, that it was originally Work, Love and Play When No One Has the Time, and the how-to part, which is in later editions, was added so Reeves would know that the book may start in overwhelm, but it doesn't stay there. So she obviously they'd realised after the first edition that lots of people were going in, as indeed I did, and thinking, this is, all this stuff about being overwhelmed is actually in itself quite overwhelming. Mm-hmm. You feel your kind of cortisol
Breathless, and other
things being triggered by the accounts that she gives of people being completely overwhelmed. And so they obviously decided a how-to was necessary to tell people that there are solutions proposed by the end of the book.
Well, what do we think of those tips at the end of the book?
Actually, that's the bit that I kind of completely lost interest in. I mean, there was sort of fun playing and trapeze trips that I just kind of could never envisage myself doing.
There's chunking, wasn't there? She goes on about how to chunk your time and to check your emails less often, both of which struck me as glaringly obvious.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose with these sort of things, that if you're looking for a solution and someone provides one at the end, then you're kind of in that moment where you might take advice and might start reappraising things that are blindingly obvious, but you haven't taken any time or, you know, not focused enough on doing it to do so, if I'm making myself clear. You know, the very act of reading the book will make you more likely to do something about it at the end than if you're just shuttling between Twitter and Facebook and email and
yes, I felt a bit like I do with lots of books of this sort, and also in other areas of talking about things like how to run a startup or other business books, that in the end, because of the book's length, you end up with so many different possible solutions that it's quite hard to tell which ones should stand out. And of course, it has an appendix that then says, here are the things that you could do. So as she advises in the introduction, you can just go skip straight to the appendix and try and work out. If you're feeling overwhelmed by having to read the book, she more or less says, then you can go to the appendix and see what the solutions are. I felt it was a bit contradictory, actually, by the time we got to the end, because at one and the same time, for example, she goes to interview various coaches and experts and academics on this topic. But, you know, one of the things proposed in the book is, you know, an acceptance of mess and the fact that everything won't be perfect. And then she goes to one of the coaches who says, well, first thing, clear your desk and clear your mind. And you think, well, where does that stop? then I'm clearing the house and decluttering, which is the kind of thing that stresses me out.
I think some of us find it very, very hard to accept mess as well. I think
I'm more relaxed about it than you two, I have to say.
No, I'm reasonably relaxed about it. You've seen my desk and it's not always tidy. But but it just struck me as contradictory to say, accept mess and then clear mess in order to get started on clearing your agenda. And then the other thing that I found contradictory in the part about how companies deal with this, which is, I think, important in a sort of policy, corporate policy sense, is there's a part where she castigates companies who don't allow people to do flexible working from home and then absolves Marissa Mayer, who famously called people back to Yahoo from their home working by pointing out that it had gone a bit chaotic for Yahoo and she needed to pull everybody in. So which is it? I mean, you know, are we saying we want to allow for home working and absolute flexibility, or are we saying we need strict rules and bringing people back in and having them meeting in and being able to talk face to face, all of which are valuable things? I mean, I think that she raises some really important issues about corporate policy.
I thought the ideal worker.
Yeah, the ideal worker
was important. So the ideal worker is the kind of this character that she's identified. I mean, a kind of a made up name, but it's, you know, somebody that's unfettered by any caring responsibilities, that can dedicate themselves to work only, and that is the worker that companies want. And, you know, anybody that falls short is somehow an imperfect worker. And I think that is true to some extent. I think that companies, I think there has been change. I wrote a magazine piece a while ago on men and work and fathers and work and how shared parental leave was kind of playing out in the UK. And so companies are trying to think about caring responsibilities, particularly as the population ages and the sandwich generation of kind of caring responsibilities to ageing parents as well as young children. But I still think that, you know, there are stigmas and penalties attached to any kind of caring. And so how companies kind of navigate this is interesting, and to see which ones work, which policies work and which ones fail is useful. And I think the kind of home working thing is interesting because I think you can have it sort of both ways. It can be messy and unhelpful, and then you need to kind of be more efficient and be clearer about some of the rules around home working so that workers know where they are with it and also managers know where they are with it.
Do you think she establishes who is responsible for this, the overwhelm, as she calls it? You know, by including self-help tips at the end, the implication is that, you know, you can do something about this and there's some responsibility that individuals have. But, you know, in the book, she's clear that organisations are not, especially in the US, are not taking responsibility. I mean, does she nail it? Who's responsible? Is it self-help against entrenched forces?
I mean, I think that's been the problem with, say, Sheryl Sandberg with her Lean In book. That was the criticism that she had, that if you're not working your way up the ladder, you've somehow got to take responsibility for leaning in and do better, when actually it could be the environment that is stacked against you, or family, or, you know, social problems. And so I think that she kind of has it every way by kind of pointing the finger at everyone. I mean, I think the problem is we're all to blame. But I mean, I think she's better than other writers in that she talks to people that are not like her, as professional, high achieving women, men, and does talk to people that are not in this position of like frantically looking at Twitter because, you know, because they've got a desk bound job that they can kind of, you know, sit around thinking a bit. She does talk to a few people that are juggling many jobs and children, and I think there was one moment where she talked to somebody that's sort of juggling three jobs or something and several children and is a single mother, and says, when do you find your leisure time? She said, maybe when I'm asleep, and yes. And that is, or a moment in church, you know, that is the only time. But none of these books really address those issues. I mean, I think she does a better job than most by talking to politicians and companies. But when it comes to policies, it tends to be, you know, the professional classes, knowledge workers.
Yes, and I think it does revert at the end, sort of the second half, once she's gone past the point about addressing the blue-collar worker and the single mum with three jobs. It does revert to being a book that where you're turning to the appendix as a knowledge worker, trying to look for tips about how to deal with your to-do list. Mm. So it's a bit, again, contradictory in that. I also thought, I'm not sure that she doesn't slightly have it both ways. There's a passage, for example, where she talks to somebody, a mother of three, who works 3 days a week for IBM in London. This woman says, a very wise client once told me, I pay you for 3 days, but you'll be thinking and solving problems all five, which she says is a virtue. Yeah. I could see as a part-timer, that would be
horrendous.
A down, that would
although,
be the downside.
Although
of it.
Elsewhere, she makes a good point, which is something that I've seen lots of people do, which is, I'm finding working hours horrendous as a full-time employee. I'm going to go freelance and do the same work for perhaps slightly less money. But, you know, I might feel more autonomous, but at the same time, I get no benefits, I get no pension. And so
no safety net
whatsoever. And I've seen lots of, certainly women do this, but men too. And that, again, is stacked in the company's favour and not your own. I mean, yes, you get a feeling that you're in control of your time, but not financially, and possibly not even really when it comes down to it. As you say, if you're working, if you're thinking in those 2 days off, then you're still working more than you should be.
Yes, and I guess where I think this book is still timely is if we are moving more towards more people doing freelance-type work. I wrote a piece last year about gig professionals, consultants who have taken on more flexible freelance roles rather than being part of a big consulting firm. And in the survey we did for that, everybody essentially said you've got to be able to cope with the volatility, obviously you're doing your own admin, all the things that you've mentioned, Emma, about not that aren't available to you, you have to cope with. Now, some people will need to have tips along the lines of this simply to stay on top of and cope with the additional problems of flexibility, if you like, the downside of flexibility. So in that sense, I think that's still useful. I would probably still go back to the appendix if I took that route and say, OK, what were the things that I brought out, that I got from that book?
Emma, I was struck by something you said earlier in the conversation. You said that you talk to Bridget Schulte. Is that something that writers do a lot across papers? Do you often talk to other writers who you admire?
Oh, I mean, by then, I think she'd left the Washington Post. So now she works for the New America Foundation on family policy. She's very thoughtful and thinks about work and family lives and the problem of childcare. I spoke to her recently about a piece I did on anxiety and how technology makes people feel that they are overwhelmed, basically. I mean, she made the point that when the pencil was introduced, people also felt overwhelmed. The introduction of new technology can make people feel that things have quickened and you can't cope.
Andrew, how do you cope with the overwhelm?
Well, I mean, I'm secretly quite like these kind of self-help books, even though they're not in themselves, to me, as enjoyable as business literature, as some other types of business literature that I also enjoy. But from a personal point of view, I do write lists. I don't consciously do it in the way that is suggested in the book, which is write down your entire to-do list and just having it written down unburdens you of having to hold it in your head. I know Tim Harford, who we mentioned earlier, has suggested this as a technique, but I do lists. I do consciously try and think about if I'm enjoying a moment, that I'm enjoying the moment and not just worrying about the next thing that I'm going to be having to do. And I do, insofar as journalists have the flexibility to do this, I do think to myself, I'm going to be more productive in the morning than in the afternoon, although oddly I have a productive period sort of between 5 and 7 p.m. when I find myself actually writing stuff. Somewhere in between the morning period and then is not the time when I should be doing
that. That's most of the day.
Yeah, most of the day between about 10 o'clock and 5 o'clock I'm singularly unproductive. But I do think about when is the part of the day that I would be most productive and try not to squander it.
Emma, what about you?
Actually, I've seen you very focused between 5 and 7. I didn't realise it was
it's a
your
thing.
Peak moment.
I think it's actually just—it may just be panic that I haven't achieved anything before 5 o'clock.
Yeah. What do I do? I think. I mean, I'm like you. I kind of go through phases of thinking I've got this nailed and enjoying the sunset and so on. And then other times, I think I said recently that when I was at my, I'd gone to my son's disco because he'd asked me to, and I'd got loads of work stacked up. And I started snapping at him because he wasn't dancing and I'd taken time out of my day to do it. which made me feel overwhelmed. I think saying no actually is the biggest thing that I'm not very good at. That's the biggest thing that I've tried to do in the last year consciously, is to say no to bits of work that I don't think I want to do or think are going to be a lot of work for little output, really. And so I think that's the biggest thing. And then I'm terrible at writing lists. I don't write lists, and I do tend to keep it all in my head, which makes it stack up.
There is an interesting journalistic lesson. As she points out, one of the things is try and do one thing every day. Well, that's very difficult for any journalist to do. But I have noticed that if somebody does come and directly commission one thing for the following day and you're forced to drop everything, there is a great liberation to that.
It's lovely.
It's stressful in a good way in that it focuses you, but it makes you realise that if you could force yourself to concentrate on one thing, you might actually get some of the benefits that she points out.
I mean, the only other thing is just not to be that person that kind of wants to achieve everything. I've kind of dropped... Oh, well, I've never been that person, really, but some of the things she was putting herself through I just thought were slightly insane.
Time management tips from top FT writers. Join us again in 2 weeks' time when we will be talking to Tim Harford, FT columnist, about his choice, Designing Your Life, How to Build a Well-Lived, Joyful Life by Bill Burnett. That podcast will be out on May the 15th. Thank you to Emma Jacobs, Andrew Hill, and to Yanina Conboy, our producer. I'm Helen Barrett, and thank you for listening.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of The Next Five podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of The Next Five wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.